everybody. It's Richard Martin here. It's Thursday afternoon, and summer is in full swing, and unfortunately, the economy is in full implosion. Obviously, since we spoke last time, the reality of the General Motors bankruptcy has become clear for all to see. Strangely enough, the General Motors stock is still trading. That's not quite clear to me why this is so. It's a little bit like the pieces of a fly which continue to kind of cavort after the fly has been killed as the nerves kind of die, I suppose. I have never seen a stock continue to trade after bankruptcy when, in my book, the stock goes to zero, the stockholders lose all their money, and then fights break out among the bondholders as to who's going to get paid. But anyway, be that as it may, I need to talk to you a little bit more about my view of what needs to be done, especially by young people living in this country who are predicating a life over the next 50, 60 years. You know, most people will not change. Too radical. Not going with the flow. Not betting against the herd. Now, the best examples in the 20th century of this were the Jews in Germany in 1933. They stayed. This, of course, included Jewish bankers, all of whom could have left. They thought they could deal with Hitler. They didn't read Mein Kampf. They didn't take it seriously. About 7% did leave. 38,000 out of 523,000. More left after 1938. By 1941, about 160,000 remained in Germany. And then, of course, emigration was closed by the Nazis. Although earlier, in fact, it was encouraged. So you see, at some price, almost all could have left. There were countries that would have let them in. They would have had to learn a new language. They would have arrived in poverty. But Jews had faced those options ever since the Assyrian captivity in the 8th century BC. So what? They all wouldn't have escaped the Nazis. Some would have moved to other European countries that were overrun by Germany after 1939. But they could have tried to get away. They stayed. They refused to acknowledge the warning signals. It can't be that bad. It got worse. Jews had an answer for worry warts. No problem. We can handle it. The Armenians went through the same thing. The Turkish massacres of 1895 were a foretaste. Most stayed behind. Then came the genocide of 1915. Look back at the economy in October 2007. The Dow was at 14,000. The banks were booming. Real estate was down a little, but the experts gave no warning. They were wrong. All of them. The U.S. government is running a $1.8 trillion deficit this year. Federal tax receipts are down 34%, which means that the deficit will go above $2 trillion. No one cares. No one says, this is the end. The American economy will never again be what it was. Think 2007. Would you have believed that Chrysler and General Motors were both headed for bankruptcy? In October 2007, General Motors shares were at $43. Now they are trading around 40 and 50 cents. There used to be an industry called investment banking. Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Goldman Sachs were not part of the commercial banking system. To survive, a few made the transition in September 2008. Some didn't make the cut. Merrill Lynch is gone. Bank of America and Citigroup were bailed out by the government. They would have gone under. They sell for a fraction of what they did in 2007. And what do most people say? No problem. There is no problem for which their answer is not no problem. Medicare will go bust. Social Security will go bust. No problem. The unemployment rate keeps rising. No problem. When people refuse to face reality because reality is going to be more painful than anything they have experienced, they look for signs that the problems they cannot avoid without changing are really not that bad. They look for offsetting good news. They think the status quo ante will return. The U.S. government is about to spend another $30 billion to buy a dead carcass of a company. It has already spent $20 billion. No problem. The government will let the company stiff bondholders for $27 billion in exchange for a 10% holding of the company, 72% owned by the government and 17% by the United Auto Workers Medical Insurance Fund. No problem. Bondholders were originally told that it would take a 90% vote to authorize this. The government has changed the rules. No problem. The company will never return to what it was. No problem. People will not buy as many cars as before from a company run by the government and the United Auto Workers. No problem. The Dow rose 100 points on the rumor that the largest bondholders will accept the deal. The deal is a disaster, but investors are in no problem mode. Somehow the wipeout is less of a wipeout. Who is going to buy a GM car instead of a Japanese car? Here is a company that is about to break its contracts with thousands of its dealers. No problem. Yet buyers are expected to trust a GM warranty. Oldsmobile is gone. No problem. Pontiac is going. No problem. Cadillac sells its cars with an ad of a flash model putting the pedal to the metal. Hot stuff. The company thinks people with money will not see through this ad. The Cadillac division has lost its way. No problem. The price-earnings ratio for the S&P 500 is over 120. Traditionally, 20 was regarded as a sell. The investor pays 120 on the hope that the stock will retain a dollar of earnings and pay investors some minimal percentage of these earnings as dividends. No problem. We are watching the investment world adopting a lemming mentality that has always produced losses. This time it's different. No problem. A conference board announced that consumer confidence is up to 55. The 50 figure is neutral, yet consumer confidence is a lagging indicator historically. When it rises, the stock market usually falls. The indicator is a reflection on what the stock market has done recently. To use consumer confidence as a justification for buying stocks is nonsense. This is like saying, I will buy stocks because the public is confident, which based on the fact that stocks have risen. If that strategy worked, stocks would never stop rising. Even hard money newsletter readers are beginning to doubt that the recent good news is, in fact, less worse than expected bad news. This is the stuff of dreams that do not come true. Readers look at the reports, and the reports look awful. Falling home prices, rising unemployment, an astronomical federal deficit. But the media say we are close to a bottom. The bottom of a crash that none of them forecast. Readers think, by the standards of late 2007, what we're seeing daily was inconceivable. Optimists speak of a slow, weak recovery. Pessimists speak of hyperinflation and depression simultaneously. But as the chorus proclaims, no problem, the public mindlessly picks up this refrain. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Yet as FDR was delivering those words, Hitler was consolidating power in Germany. Stalin was beginning the purges. A quarter of the U.S. workforce was unemployed. But Roosevelt began the phrase, no problem. 4 years later, unemployment was still 20%. The federal deficit had ballooned. Happy days were not here again. Your friends don't want to hear your pessimism anymore. They don't want to change. They will refuse to change. In 1934, Ludwig von Mises realized that Hitler, an Austrian, would seek to bring Austria under German hegemony. He warned Jewish economists to leave. They had been his students at his famous seminar in Vienna. Fritz Machlup believed him and came to the U.S. So did Gottfried Herbeler. Mises went to Switzerland as a professor, leaving his great personal library behind. He fled to the U.S. in 1940 after France had fallen. He never got a full-time teaching job again. A few listened, most did not. No problem. Count the costs. This is what people have refused to do. They have counted the cost of doing something radical. It's high. They have counted the immediate cost of doing nothing new. It seems low. They prefer doing nothing. But what about the long term? What about, one, retirement, no social security or Medicare? Two, the federal deficit, $1.8 trillion this year. Three, the Federal Reserve's monetary base, doubled. Four, falling house prices. Five, rising unemployment. Six, the war in Afghanistan, forever until America's defeat. No problem. How do you reason with these people? Answer, you don't. If you value your time and your privacy, if you turn out to be wrong, you will be ridiculed or at least treated as a child. If you are correct, you will be hated. You will also be hit up for money. If you are Christian, you will be told you are heartless. You will become a line of credit for those whose mantra was, no problem. They don't want to change. They will not change. They will not listen to you. And when things turn out much worse than even most newsletter writers are forecasting, you will be hated. Are you prepared for this? Do you have a real plan to deal with what is obviously an unfolding disaster? Rising government ownership, massive deficits, rising unemployment, falling housing prices, busted retirement pensions, rising interest rates, falling corporate bonds, and Federal Reserve inflation on a scale never seen in American history? Or do you think you can delay? No problem. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in today's world. It's bad, if not a catastrophe. We must keep our heads above water. A tsunami is coming. In such a scenario, you have got to get out of the water and off the beach. But few people ever do, unless they have seen a tsunami. Few have. Put your mind to tsunami avoidance and do it quietly. What do you really think is likely to happen? Not what you prefer will happen. Think General Motors in October 2007. Think Chrysler, Merrill Lynch, and Lehman Brothers. No one saw it coming. It came. Problems, my friends. Big, big problems. All right, this is Richard Martin of the Richard Martin Wake Up Call, coming to you for these last few weeks from Miami in Florida. Please feel free to call in with your questions, and please make those questions by calling the toll-free number at 888-873-4643. Once more, the toll-free number is 1-888-873-4643. If you would like to email the questions, the email address remains rmartin@lataminv.com. Repeat that once more. rmartin@lataminv, that's LATAMINV for Latin American Investments, .com. And if you would like to call me in private to discuss your personal affairs and concerns, my direct line, which is available to you at all times, is 305-579-2012. Once more, my private email phone line is 305-579-2012. Well, here we are, 16 months into this millennial depression and less than a business quarter into Obama's administration, and it is inescapably clear that the Obama team hasn't the slightest idea of what it's doing. To pretend otherwise is nothing more than self-deception. So let's take a look at some of the details. Start with the banks. Well, the stress test was so obviously so much window dressing that it's rather questionable what utility the whole process actually served. I mean, look, the banks negotiated the results of the test. This is a far cry from Roosevelt's bank holiday in March 1933. A far cry? It's a whole other musical genre. But even if the stress tests had been on the up and up, it's clear that the Obama team would not do what has to be done, which is to say, nationalize the banks, fire the management, liquidate the stockholders, write off the bad assets, get the bondholders to take haircuts, or quasi-decapitations, as the case may be, and turn the banks around and send them on their way, FDIC style. Why they won't do this is beside the point. Through capture by Wall Street, akin to state capture of East European governments by the native oligarchy, that seems to be the general consensus. Regardless, the banks are zombies, and they will remain zombies indefinitely. Zombie banks can undercut solvent competitive banks, strangling financial competition and, ironically, curtailing market liquidity, because the zombies know they will always be propped up by Uncle Sam. Sorry for the mixed metaphors, but you get the idea. This is exactly what happened and is still happening in Japan. Zombie banks will take the government's largesse, lend out no money, squeeze out their non-zombie competition, and wind up turning the entire financial industry zombie. And the Obama team has no idea how to stop this, aside from shoveling even more liquidity in their direction. Or maybe they do know what has to be done, which is to put the FDIC receivership bullet in the brains of these zombies, but they actually lack the political courage to do so. Either way, the result is the same. Zombies everywhere, killing everything, ironically curtailing liquidity even as they are propped up in the name of improving liquidity. The charitable conclusion here is this shows that the Obama team doesn't have the foresight to envision the obvious traps of allowing zombie banks to exist. Hence, they don't have an overall plan for the banking sector. If they did, they'd realize the perniciousness of zombie banks and therefore put a stop to them by setting up a real stress test and putting the banks that failed it, no matter their size, into receivership. The uncharitable and probably much more likely conclusion is that the Obama team are nothing but captured lackeys of Wall Street. Well, let's have a look at industry. The Obama team's capitulation to entrenched interests in the automobile sector, that is the United Auto Workers Union, is a very, very bad sign. The government's involvement, instead of being good for Chrysler and GM in their respective bankruptcy processes and shielding upstream suppliers from the harm of a drawn-out bankruptcy, will actually mean that the business decisions of these two companies will effectively be beholden to political considerations from here on out. After all, The reason these companies were nationalized was in order to save the UAW's bacon. By the way, to compare what's going on at GM and Chrysler today to Chrysler in 1980, as so many people are trying to do, is apples and Agent Orange. In 1980, the U.S. government guaranteed Chrysler's bonds. In 2009, the U.S. government is guaranteeing Chrysler and GM too, by the way. Moreover, the Obama team hasn't presented any rationale for the de facto nationalization of Chrysler and GM. So what's to stop any other industry or union from asking to be nationalized? I'm not one of those idiots who says that any state-run enterprise is communist or socialist. I would prefer bankruptcy for an insolvent business, but on principle, I have no problem with a government takeover of a business or industry so long as there is a clear, compelling, non-trivial, non-political reason and so long as there is a clear horizon for the exit of the government, if the interference was for exigent or unique reasons. But the arbitrary de facto nationalization of Chrysler and GM through this sham, and probably illegal pre-packed bankruptcy, has no rationale, no raison d'etre, aside from propping up some union, which is receiving this shockingly sweet and possible illegal deal in the Chrysler case, a deal presumably to be repeated in the GM bankruptcy. The way it's being done makes no rational business sense, but makes terrific political sense. These are the twin problems with the Obama team and their auto industry meddling. It's not that they are meddling in the private sector. It's that they're giving priority to political considerations over financial or macroeconomic ones. And they're meddling without a clear and compelling rationale, opening the door for every private business to seek state subsidy so long as they have the political muscle to get the sweet taxpayer-financed deal out of the Obama team. This shows the Obama team's lack of an overall plan, coupled with a lack of faith in capitalism and bankruptcy, a lack of faith that the laws and system in place will actually do what they're supposed to do. When an administration doesn't have faith in the law, it starts to break it. If you don't believe me, ask the Bushes. So let's look at the military. No one is noticing this. And I know I'm an odd man out on this subject, but weapons procurements and excessively large military expenditures, above and beyond the two wars being fought, are continuing apace, and no one is saying a thing. This is a disaster. Military weapons are, by definition, expensive. They're a waste of money, at best of any inefficient redistribution of income from taxpayers to workers on the factory floors of the weapons manufacturers. The exorbitant military spending going on is a tremendous drain on the economy. It doesn't seem so because the economy has been so used to it, and because in the good times it wasn't such a pressing issue. Keep in mind, the millennial depression is the first truly serious economic downturn since the end of the Cold War. But even during the Cold War, when the Soviet Union presented an obvious and equal military challenge, there were cutbacks in 81 and after 73, as well as in the 50s, when the economy got rocky. Now, with no serious or imminent enemy except low-tech terrorists, we have a massive military industry above and beyond the endless, pointless occupations in Afghanistan and Iraq. The military would be the obvious place to start cutting. Is the Obama team cutting? The Obama team's failure to cut non-occupation military expenditures shows a lack of political will, even though from a rational point of view, cutting weapons procurements and the excessive military in order to redirect those monies to more productive, more clearly stimulative programs is obvious and indeed necessary, if the rationale for the recently passed stimulus package is to be believed. Yet the Obama team does not have the will to do so. So now, of course, we come to the deficit, the ultimate issue. The Obama team delivered on its promise to stimulate. Boy, did they deliver. What a doozy of a stimulus package. And the financing of the stimulus? Deficit. The constitutional traitor Dick Cheney declared that deficits don't matter, and the Obama team is drinking from the same Kool-Aid. The budget deficit is being financed by the emission of treasury bills, notes, and bonds. This year, I believe, $2.3 trillion worth of treasury paper will be sold. Question. What happens when there are no buyers for those treasuries? Don't tell me it can't happen. That's what they told me last year about Lehman going under, and then they said the same thing about AIG. In the millennial depression, anything can happen. Simple maths makes it obvious that those treasuries won't find foreign buyers like before. Not when the petro-states are selling less oil and at cheaper prices than a year ago. Not when China and Japan are exporting a fraction of what they did before. The Fed is willing and able to buy those treasuries, effectively printing money, and the Obama team is okay with that. No budget cuts, just print money. Is anyone else realizing that the dollar will eventually crash if this isn't stopped, or am I whistling Dixie in a hurricane? This shows that the Obama team is either willfully irresponsible in its cavalier attitude towards the currency, or else hasn't seriously thought through what a crash of treasuries and a run on the dollar could actually mean for the United States. I can tell you what will happen. In a nutshell, it will mean out-and-out chaos. Fighting in the streets over food. It's happened before, elsewhere, and in the U.S. immediately after the Civil War. No reason to believe it can't happen in America today. All right, well, this is a quick recap, light on detail, maybe a bit on the hyperbolic side, yes. But you who are listening to this, or an obsessive like me, know all the details already. You can fill in those blanks. And the picture they paint is unmistakably clear. The Obama team is lost. It has no guiding principles or overall plan, and they're making it up as they go along. I didn't even go into abortions like the PPIP or the collapsing balance sheets of the state and local governments, which the federal government is doing nothing to alleviate, or the looming pension fund blow-up, not to mention credit card asset blow-ups, happening even now as I speak. CMBS blow-ups, which are about to hit like Katrina, and on and on and on. I don't have to mention any of this. All these details only add to the picture. The Obama team gives a great speech with huge, happy masks firmly in place. But behind the masks, there is nothing. No plan, no vision for the end game or the way out of this millennial depression. No idea what to do except put out every little fire that pops up in front of them while the general conflagration goes on all around. The Obama team doesn't even believe that they should do nothing, on the assumption that time alone will heal the banks and the economy. If they really believed that time itself would be the cure for the current ills, they wouldn't have passed such an aggressive stimulus package, or be playing with legal fire in the Chrysler and General Motors bankruptcies, or playing with financial Armageddon with the shockingly massive Treasury paper sale. Ladies and gentlemen, the Obama team doesn't have a clue what it's doing. Behind the happy mask of green shoots and hope we can believe in, there is nothing. Just a plastic, reassuring, empty smile. On the zombie banks, the mechanism here is different from Japan, although you get to the more or less the same place. As John Hempton points out, corporations were saddled with debt which should have been written down or off, but instead weren't. So companies weren't borrowing and were trying to pay down the debt, and banks were sitting there with deposits and not lending. The U.S. is in debt up to its eyeballs, but unlike Japan, Americans have fat lending spreads. The benefit of the super cheap funding and the subsidies is not even partially being passed on to borrowers. Banks are increasing fees and not lowering spread commensurate with before them their funding costs. While some reduction in lending is salutary, too many weak credits got loans, the increases in charges are in many cases indiscriminate. High spreads are feeding the banks at the expense of enterprise. And as far as the auto companies are concerned, I don't see the solution as being about saving the UAW's bacon. For General Motors, intransigent bondholders have proven to be a bigger impediment than the union. I see this more of a, this is what deal the guys could craft, as opposed to being as politicized as Lira suggests. Some companies with high levels of union ownership used to be models of efficient and responsive manufacturing. I'm very disturbed that there was not a single auto industry expert involved in this process. There is a good team at MIT, and I'm sure there were other sources too. Okay, well, let's... No questions coming through on the toll-free line. I'll give it to you again. It's 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. Okay, a few items of mail here. Let's start with, we have two rants today. One comes from Steve and one from Frank. Let's start with Steve's rant, written late on Monday afternoon. Richard, I'm not a conspiracy-oriented person, but while looking into cap and trade, I feel I have stumbled into what may be the biggest conspiracy of all time. Cap and trade is a tax on the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide, but completely overlooks the gas methane, which is a much more dangerous offender. I was shocked to find out that the world's bovine population is the prime source of methane pollution. You have to ask how the world's bovine population has kept out of the news for over 100 years. I think I have discovered how. Cows have learned to do exactly as politicians have learned to do, and that is to align themselves with the business community to advance their agenda. The politician seeks re-election, and the cows seek total world domination. That may seem alarming, but they have been at it since about 1910. They started by creating a demand for milk products. Yes, as simple as that, to get humans involved in consuming milk, having it delivered to your door, before refrigeration, milk was delivered with some ice on top. Homogenized milk was a giant step forward for the bovine revolution, as it made every glass of milk in the bottle taste the same. Catchy phrases like, you never outgrow your need for milk, and got milk, smiling cows on billboards, milk in public schools, were big steps up. In the 1950s, we developed a taste for burgers. This was a huge advance in the bovine movement. They suffered some setbacks, such as mad cow and a weak vegetarian movement that were quickly glossed over. My beef with the cow is they have four very large stomachs to produce methane, and I have only one. They have large lungs to exhale CO2, and my lungs are small. We have only 12 billion cows worldwide, and only 6 billion of us. I feel that the cow pumps out 15 times the pollution that I do, so why should I have to be taxed? The cow is given a free ride. I would hope at some point the UN might step up to the plate, perhaps a trial in the world court, find the cows guilty of genocide and sentence them to death. If that is too strong and angers the anti-death penalty folks, we could tax the owners of cows $10,000 a head. I lean to the $10,000 tax solution, as that could pay down our debt, drive up the price of burgers to $1,200 each, less burgers, less need for health care. If this problem is ignored when mankind goes extinct, the last man standing will be a cow. Thanks for the wake-up call, Steve Kruger. Oh, Steve, thank you so much. Always going to be depended upon to brighten up our day. How nice. All right, DC... wrote in saying, what about retirement to Singapore? We have never heard you speak about whether a retired person could retire there and live on a small pension. I rather think that might be hard, DC. Prices are quite high in Singapore, especially real estate. It's very pricey in Singapore right now. I kind of think you really have to be working there to make it happen for you. There are plenty of other places in Asia which are pleasant to live in. Malaysia, of course, comes to mind. Lots of people have gone to Thailand. And Singapore, remember, is just a big city. It's about 5 miles by 25 miles. So it doesn't really lend itself to the kind of retirement processes that would normally be associated with, time on the golf course and on the beach and in the pools and stuff. It's not really that kind of place. But don't let me dissuade you. come and have a look. You never know. We might even get to have a coffee. All right. Thank you, DC. Nice to hear from you. Okay. What else do we have here? Well, Frank wrote in a while back. He said, Richard, it is said that when all you have is a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. As I survey the government, I have concluded that we are all proctologists. From the Hoxpole, Frank. How nice. Thank you very much, Frank. Good. Well, now, Reuters came out with a report which has caused quite a stir, and it's appeared on lots of blogs, and many people are talking about this. It's about medical bills underlying 60% of the U.S. bankruptcies, and it's a study. Most bankrupt families had health insurance. 92% had medical bills over $5,000. And I've seen it, as I say, on several blogs, including the homepage of the Progressive Radio Network. I happened upon it this morning when I was looking for something else. But I did think that I would just like to bring it to your attention, ladies and gentlemen, because it is quite shocking, really, if you reflect on the parlous state of the medical industry here and how the citizens are being really ripped to pieces. Medical bills are apparently behind more than 60% of U.S. personal bankruptcies. U.S. researchers reported Thursday in a report they said demonstrates that healthcare reform is on the wrong track. More than 75% of these bankrupt families had health insurance but still were overwhelmed by their medical debts. The team at Harvard Law School, Harvard Medical School, and Ohio University reported in the American Journal of Medicine. Unless you're Warren Buffett, your family is just one serious illness away from bankruptcy. That was from Dr. David Himmelstein from Harvard, who said in a statement, and he's an advocate for a single-payer health insurance program for the United States. For middle-class Americans, health insurance offers little protection, he said. Well, the United States is embarking on an overhaul of its healthcare system, now a patchwork of public programs such as Medicare for the elderly and disabled and employer-sponsored health insurance that leaves 15% of the population with no coverage. The researchers and some consumer advocates said the study showed the proposals under the most serious consideration are unlikely to help many Americans. They are pressing for a so-called single-payer plan in which one agency, usually the government, coordinates health coverage. And then a Dr. Sidney Wolfe of the Health Research Group at Public Citizen said in a statement, expanding private insurance and calling it health reform will fail to prevent financial catastrophe for hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. About 170 million people get health insurance through an employer, but President Barack Obama says soaring health care costs hurt the economy and force businesses to drop medical insurance for their workers. The report reads, nationally, a quarter of firms cancel coverage immediately when an employee suffers a debilitating illness. Another quarter do so within a year. Obama told Congress on Wednesday he was open to making mandatory health insurance part of the overhaul. Neither Congress nor Obama are considering the kind of single-payer plan advocated by Public Citizen Himmelstein and his colleague, Dr. Steffi Woolhandler. We need to rethink health reform, Woolhandler said. Covering the uninsured isn't enough. Only single-payer national health insurance can make universal, comprehensive coverage affordable by saving the hundreds of billions we now waste on insurance overhead and bureaucracy. The research studied 2,134 random families who filed for bankruptcy between January and April in 2007, before the current recession began. They used public bankruptcy court records and surveyed 1,032 people by telephone. And they wrote, using a conservative definition, 62.1% of all bankruptcies in 2007 were medical. 92% of these medical debtors had medical debts over $5,000, or 10% of pre-tax family income. Most medical debtors were well-educated, owned homes, and had middle-class occupations. The researchers funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation said the share of bankruptcies that could be blamed on medical problems rose by 50% from 2001 to 2007. Patients with multiple sclerosis paid a mean of $34,167 out-of-pocket in 2007. Diabetics paid $26,971, and those with injuries paid $25,096, the researchers found. A very, very shocking state of affairs, as I'm sure you will all agree. A little bit on real estate that I wanted to talk to you about. Last week, the Fitch Ratings estimated that up to 75% of the modifications now being done... I'm looking at my screen here, and I'm seeing we have Mark from New York on standby. Let's take Mark's call before we continue. Hi, Mark. Is Mark there? We have no Mark. Oh, dear. Well, he must have given up. I didn't see it. Well, let me continue on then with what I was talking about. I'm sorry, I had a little problem with the emails here, so I didn't get to see your call, Mark. I'm sorry. Last week, Fitch Ratings estimated that up to 75% of the modifications now being done through the administration's Making Home Affordable program will redefault in 6 months to a year. I'm not talking about the old modifications, which were largely repayment plans that could actually raise monthly payments. I'm talking about the new mods, which lower monthly payments to 31% of a person's income. So anyway, this is Fitch's reasoning. And it comes from Diane Pendley, managing director at Fitch, who said that the problem is not on the front-end ratio, but on the back-end, which is all of the borrower's other debt, i.e. credit cards, car loans, student loans, etc. She said that in talking with servicers, she's hearing other debt is so high that most of today's troubled borrowers cannot afford any loan payment at all, even at a very modest debt-to-income ratio. She said, just getting the house payment done doesn't mean their lifestyle is sustainable. She continued, another problem is that with home prices continuing to fall, more and more borrowers who are essentially just renting their mortgages now because they will never see any home equity are walking away. Even if the mortgage payment is low, the property taxes and home maintenance costs are padding that payment. And without an upside to the investment, there's simply no reason to pay. Suffice it to say, the foreclosure crisis of the high and low ends is not getting any better. And actually, it gets worse. The Mortgage Bankers Association noted that a record 12%, or 1 in 8 homeowners in the U.S., are now behind on their payments or in foreclosure. 10.6% of the mortgages in Florida are now somewhere in the process of actual foreclosure. It would be scary if you had to sell. There are new developments that have only 10% actual occupancy, as the bulk of the condos were bought for speculation. Now, those 10% of buyers are having to shoulder all the fees for upkeep. And, of course, nobody will buy because the upkeep costs can be more than the mortgage. It's just a vicious cycle. In Nevada, foreclosures are 7.8%. In Arizona, 5.6%. In California, 5.2%. 25% of subprime loans are now in foreclosure. 14% of FHA, which is government or taxpayer-guaranteed loans, and a growing 6% of all prime loans are now in foreclosure. Even if the seasonal adjustments may overstate the numbers, we are in new territory in terms of actual foreclosures. And the MBA release read as follows. In looking at these numbers, it is important to focus on what has changed as well as what continues to be the key drivers of foreclosures. What has changed is the shifting of the problem somewhat away from the subprime and option ARM Alt-A loans to the prime fixed-rate loans. The foreclosure rate on prime fixed-rate loans has doubled in the last year, and for the first time since the rapid growth of subprime lending, prime fixed-rate loans now represent the largest share of new foreclosures. In addition, almost half the overall increase in foreclosure starts we saw in the first quarter was due to the increase in prime fixed-rate loans. How could so many prime loans be in foreclosure? These were people with good credit and jobs. Well, the answer is the very deep and lengthy recession, or depression, coupled with high and rising unemployment. The number of foreclosures will not abate until an unemployment starts to fall. And even optimistic forecasts assume unemployment will keep rising into 2010. And I see unemployment already in the next sighting of the statistics at approaching 10%. Interestingly enough, just the other day there was a New York Times editorial entitled Foreclosures, No End in Sight, and as part of that, and I quote, "A continuing steep drop in home prices combined with rising unemployment is powering a new wave of foreclosures. Unfortunately, there's little evidence so far that the Obama administration's anti-foreclosure plan will be able to stop it. One of the biggest problems is that the plan focuses almost entirely on lowering monthly payments. But overly onerous payments are only part of the problem. For 15.4 million underwater borrowers, those who owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth, a lack of home equity puts them at risk of default even if their monthly payments have been reduced. They have no cushion to fall back on in the event of a setback, like job loss or illness. There will be no recovery until there is a halt in the relentless rise in foreclosures. Foreclosures threaten millions of families with financial ruin. By driving prices down, they sap the wealth of all homeowners. They exacerbate bank losses, putting pressure on the still fragile financial system. Lower monthly payments are a balm, but they are no substitute for home equity. And until more Americans can find a good job and a steady paycheck, the number of foreclosures will continue to rise. In previous housing busts, foreclosures continued to rise until prices finally bottomed. And prices will fall, and foreclosures will rise for some time. There is no end in sight." Again, I repeat, ladies and gentlemen, that comes directly from the New York Times editorial. And if you think that residential real estate is where we're looking, let me assure you that commercial real estate will blow up any way you look at it. They were leveraged way more than the residential real estate. Many investors bought commercial real estate with 1% down. Many will need to refinance and won't be able to. The banks aren't that stupid. They will not lend using crazy criteria anymore. If you look at many commercial real estate buildings selling right now, they're already 30 to 50% off from the top, and that is reality. So where will the money come to fuel this new rise? 70% of GDP is consumer spending. You know, the money comes from home equity lines, which are gone, credit cards, with personal credit is likely to contract $4 trillion in the next 2 years. From jobs, well, we're losing 500,000 to 600,000 jobs a month. Real unemployment is 18% right now. And stocks, of course, don't need to talk about that. So tell me, where will the money come from? That's all I ask. It's the question I ask every day of the week, at least once. And I never get a reply. You're looking at corporate and state pension obligations blowing up right now. California is, of course, bankrupt. The pension plans will very soon confess that they really cannot pay. I'm going to predict that you will see riots, protests from the teachers, the firemen, and the police. The corporations will soon admit that they can't pay either. You know, you start playing around with people's money, let me assure you, the people will react. Interest rates are soaring right now as I speak, and have been for the past month. The Fed said that they were buying treasuries, but rates have been rising instead of falling. People aren't stupid. Using debt to pay off debt is dumb. The Fed's printing money to give to the banks via the government is kind of dumb when you consider that the private banks are the Feds. The high rates will kill real estate and borrowing. Gas and food prices will rise. Assets such as stocks and real estate will plummet. This is a depression of the first order. That is what we have to look forward to. We're going to have to move away from this paper pushing. But this won't happen for a while. You know, manufacturing in this country has been given away for the past two decades. And now the middle class is being squeezed. The good jobs are leaving or gone. But out of the $12 trillion committed by the government, about $200 billion is what's being committed to infrastructure. When will people realize that 90% of the money going to bail out bankrupt institutions are supporting zombie financial concerns that need to just go away? You know, as in any survival situation, the weak must die and be replaced by the smart and strong. You're not going to be able to solve any of these problems until this tragedy is resolved. You know, forget about all these social commentators like Thomas Friedman and Paul Krugman, and even the dead ones like Keynes. Minsky will ultimately be proven correct. But in the process of learning this, we will all have to pay, and our children will have to pay thereafter. Well, we've got a few minutes left here. We've just got time, I think, to have a quick go at... Well, maybe we don't have time, but I'll answer a couple more questions. I was going to read a rant from... I promised you a rant from Frank, but I think time will run out on us, so I will hold that over till next time, ladies and gentlemen, and answer two more questions. One comes from Bill Adamo, who says, Richard, how often do they change the Dow weightings? How much are these indexes manipulated? Well, it's very simple, Bill. They are changed, their weightings change whenever, you know, there is a blow-up in one of the companies, and the company goes usually below $5 a share. Incredibly enough, there was General Motors trading at below $1 a share, and still, not only in the New York Stock Exchange, where it should have been eliminated by law, but also in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It seems that people can't let it go, which is why it's still, why the share is still trading today, as I told you at the beginning of this talk. And for your information, General Electric is now the only company that was around when the Dow Jones Industrials were formulated back at the end of the 19th century. So there's just one holdout. All the rest have gone. Obviously, manipulated may or may not be a good word, Bill, but what we're talking about, obviously, is them putting in young, dynamic companies to replace the old ones, without which the Dow would be a lot lower today, and quite frankly, without which the Dow would never have made a new high in 2007, basis the old high made at the beginning of the century. So you can see the extent of the manipulation just from that statistic alone. And there are only 30 stocks. So when they get rid of one like General Motors and put in a strong one like Cisco, which has come in, and Travelers Corp, which is an insurance company, it's going to make the Dow much more volatile and much more prone to, I wasn't going to say manipulation per se, because that's already a form of manipulation, putting in young, healthy stocks to replace the old ones. But you don't want to pay too much attention to these indexes anyway. I would like to just finish your email here, Bill. The Dow is weighted by price, so adding Apple and Google, which each have triple-digit share prices, could have been more disruptive. Cisco at $19 won't have as much as IBM Corp at $106. Google, at 417, would have vaulted to the most influential Dow stock. By comparison, Cisco will have a roughly 2% weighting. Well, thank you very much for the email. I came across a comment which I thought was worthy of your attention, ladies and gentlemen, from Randall Forsyth and his clever phrase turning. He turns his poison pen on the ubiquitous nonsense known as the green shoots that has been so in vogue among the perma-wrong crowd. I'd always said the green shoots came from the film Idiocracy, but nobody else has mentioned that, so maybe not. And he said, and Randall Forsyth's comment is, so, why the attraction of green shoots? One can only speculate that they must be in some ways intoxicating. Perhaps not the shoots exactly, or the stems or the seeds, but the leaves of a certain plant. Those might be smoked or otherwise ingested to bring about a euphoric effect. From what I've read, the current crop is far more potent than the commodity available in years past. How else to explain the mind-bending notion that an economy that is declining less quickly is somehow improving? Like all great inventions, it's obvious in hindsight. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. This is Richard Martin, the end of another hour. I will be back with you at 1 p.m. Eastern on Monday, and I have to wish you a very nice, comfortable, and relaxing weekend. See you then. Bye-bye.